Okay, you need to flip on the microphone. And make you guys please make sure you speak into your microphone. Thank you.
Welcome to the Planning Commission meeting in Cedar Hills, Utah, dated today, November 27th, 2018. I'd like to recognize Garrett Anderson and Marie Kraft as voting members this evening. The first topic on the agenda is public comment has been set aside for the public to express ideas, concerns, comments, any topic they'd like to communicate and talk about for 3 minutes per person. I don't see anybody signed up to do so. So, again, public comment. So I will close the public comment portion of the meeting. First agenda item is approval of the minutes from October 23rd, 2018 Planning Commission meeting. I was the person not in attendance, so I don't know if they're accurate or not.
I resolve some technical issues.
Okay. I will entertain a motion on the topic.
I move that we approve the meeting minutes on the October 23rd, Planning Commission meeting.
And is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The next topic is review recommendation and public hearing on amendments to the city's general plan related to adopting moderate income houses development. So, what I'd like to do, Chandler, I presume you have something to talk about. And when you get done, we'll have a public hearing.
Yeah.
And then we'll commence with a discussion.
Sounds good.
Chatter questions. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Just give some background. The Land Use Development Management Act, the state of Utah dictates that cities shall have a moderate income housing plan. And this is something the city can lack in their general plan for a while. Anyway, this became a focal point for the last legislative session in this previous year, where there's, I don't know if you've been tuned into the news and seen the number of articles on the housing crisis that is currently affecting Utah, where there's more people desiring to live than there are places that have been made available. And it also that with that is that housing prices are such here that it's become quite affordable to build in the area. So a lot of the blame gets shifted onto people coming in from out of state. However, studies have shown that the vast majority is actually homegrown. It's people that have grown up here and want to stay here. Tonight we have a moderate income housing plan, and I'm going to strongly suggest that the Planning Commission approves something tonight. The reason that is the next legislative session is going to start in January, and we're one of the few communities that do not have a moderate income housing plan. Now, this is something that the Planning Commission and the City Council can revisit anytime you want. So we can even have, we can approve it tonight, we can have it on the next agenda if you some issues. But I don't want to go into the next legislative session being one of the communities that does not have a moderate income housing plan. Now, the state is even going so far this year, there's a real push, there's a real battle, if you will, at the state for local control. Cities want to be able to dictate zoning and how they foresee the priorities of their community, and they want to be able to enact ordinances that reflect those priorities. They want to have local control. They want to be able to dictate what happens in their community. A lot of the state legislature does not like what happens at the local level, and so there's always a give and take, push and pull between the state and localities and municipalities on local control. And there's going to be a real fight this year, I'm afraid, that there's some legislatures that would like to remove some of those powers and duties that have been granted by the state to municipalities and bring them back to the state. It's not unprecedented. It's happened before in California. And on top of that, if you do not have a moderate income housing plan, the state is starting to look at bills that will enact certain penalties that will be enforced on municipalities that don't have a moderate income housing plan. This last year, I don't want to call it a penalty, but it felt like a penalty, was that the state took 1% of every city's, that's why it's not a penalty, because I've never really paid it, but it's 1% of our sales tax revenue, and redirected that money, rather than us getting it, it redirected it to communities that have homeless shelters. That's obviously very, very low in housing. It's not what we're talking about tonight, but nonetheless, they felt like the impact that these homeless shelters were having on these four communities in Salt Lake were creating such a burden on the public safety needs of these communities that they felt that it was necessary that all cities chip in and help pay for their public safety. Now, it was kind of an unprecedented move for the state to take in that they went into what is normally revenue guaranteed to the city and redirecting that in the state. So they've done that once now. It's just 1%. You know, for the city our size, we're looking at $16,000 to $18,000. But they've done it once. And so is the penalty next time? Well, that 1% wasn't enough. And if you're not helping solve the problem, we're going to make it 3%, we're going to make it 4%. I don't know. And they could come up with penalties other than that. It could be a restriction on VNC road funds. It could be a number of issues that they have, of monies that we get from the state that they could redirect elsewhere. So there's a real concern on my part that we have a moderate income housing plan in place, even if we're not totally comfortable with it, because it's something that we can go back and revisit. Any questions on that?
Before we begin, question and answer, we have a public hearing. Are you done presenting?
No.
Okay. 1%?
Okay. All right. So given that background, let's talk about the actual moderate income housing plan that's being proposed. Cedar Hills has a unique set of challenges, and I know I don't need to beat the drum here in that there's not a lot of land. We're not like American Fork just approved a 10,000 person subdivision, which is like moving Cedar Hills. So we have our own unique set of challenges in that I would estimate that our residential area is 90% to 95% built out, with the remaining areas that are not built are either infill development, they're already approved, or they already have certain grants given to them as far as single family loans, or they're on the hillside and they're very, very difficult to, or cost prohibitive to, or to develop. Not to say that they can't, just saying maybe time is not right. Anyway, the city has been working with the Mountain Land Association of Governments on developing this moderate income housing plan. They've taken some census data and some other, where did we get it from? It was the American, it's some survey from that is used in all the housing plans. Anyway, they kind of give us our affordable housing calculation, and in the document that was provided to the Planning Commission, you can see a red section where we added some verbiage, kind of dictating or telling the story of our background and how A, we're built out, B, our demographics don't lend itself very well to moderate income housing. Part of what you find when you see low to moderate income housing is you see job opportunities around. You see transit opportunities as well. So the people that may not be able to afford a car, but they can afford a home, they can get on a bus and go to a job, they can walk out of their home and go to a job. This is not the case here. We don't have a UTD stop. We actually get one that comes once a day, but it's not enough to promote any sort of moderate income housing development. So we wanted to make sure that when we submit this to the state is aware of our unique nature. And I don't want to say it's unique to us because there are other communities. I would say Highland, Alpine are very similar. So it's Pleasant View of the county. So a very similar community to us. So I hope you've had a chance to go through the moderate income housing plan. And then we sent out the so that there's the plan kind of dictating where we are currently. And then the thing that I think the focal point of the discussion tonight needs to be around is what was sent out the other day, which was the goals, policies, and objectives. Given our constraints, given our demographics, given what we face here, what can we do? And even though we have some serious challenges to promoting rural water income housing, I think that there are certain things that the city can and has done already to promote moderate income housing without changing the nature of the community drastically.
Can I ask, did our fellow commissioners get a copy, get that email of the revised documents that came out?
Okay, so you said that.
And how were the revised documents dispersed to the public?
There's in the packet. They'll be in the packet.
They're on the website and the public notice website. The cities and the public notice.
All right. Anything else?
We can have a public hearing.
Okay. All right, I'm going to put the public hearing on the topic of amendments to the city's general plan relating to adopting moderate income housing development. Is there anybody here from the public that would like to make public comment on this topic at this time? So you have 3 minutes and you may speak to this topic if you'd like. Seeing none, I will now close the public hearing on the amendments to the city's general plan relating to adopting a moderate income housing development.
Can I talk a little bit about the goals?
Yes, let's talk about the goals.
All right, so goals, they're not created out of thin air. There's a proposed bill that's going to be before the legislature in a month that kind of stipulates that cities shall be doing one of these, or three of these things, which is a number of them, but we feel like we can comply with it, we already can comply with it. So without going into any of the objectives or policies, goal number one is to create, allow for, and reduce regulations related to accessory dwelling units and residential zones. This is something the city's already addressed in this doing. Two is allow for housing in commercial and industrial zones. Once again, this is something the city has done. However, we just rezoned that whole thing for residential. I don't know if it would be affordable, though. Three is consider utilization of programs made available to municipalities to assist in the promotion and development of moderate housing. And then we see down there in the objectives, it's with the Utah Housing, it says corporation, I believe that should be to say coalition, the Department of Workforce Services. And then goal number four would be allow for single room occupancy. Those are the goals that as a staff, we felt like it was something that we could promote without changing how the city looks and feels. Any questions? We've never talked about single room occupancy. Single room occupancy is actually something that we kind of already allow. So it'd be like a group home setting. So we allow it in our family code, we allow foreign related individuals to live together as a housekeeping unit, is what we call it. So it'd be the same thing as that. It'd be you own your home, you rent it out to three other individuals. That's it. We already allow it. In a kind of roundabout way, the way that our family definition works, the same thing that if a group home came in, they would have four unrelated individuals, we would treat them the same as any other group living arrangement. But it might be helpful to spell it out a little bit clearer.
So, Jared, do you have a question?
Yeah. I thought it was helpful last month, Shannon, when we actually identified how many specific units this actually equates to in cities.
It's difficult just given where we are. Let me explain that in that we've allowed for example, accessory dwelling units. We've allowed for accessory dwelling units for a long time. I want to say probably a decade or more. However, I felt like our restrictions and the processes in order to get an approved accessory dwelling unit were so cumbersome and prohibitive cost wise and possibly building wise. That to date, as of June, I want to say we have a grand total of zero, maybe one in the hopper. So by changing the code, by getting rid of any requirement for them to pay impact fees, getting rid of any requirement for them to drastically change their home, other than basic safety measures as required by state law, We're starting to see those come through a lot more. So we're starting to get a best estimate. Best guess estimate would be that there's probably a minimum of 10% of the homes in Cedar Hills have some sort of accessory dwelling. I think that's being conservative. So you could think about that. That's about 250 homes. I know that there are a couple of group living arrangements, like the single or the single room occupancies. So it's hard to get a completely accurate gauge on where we are. But my feeling is that the state is more concerned about where we're going rather than where we are. That's why I feel like the goals, policies, objectives are really what the state's going to be looking at.
So can you explain further about the timing and the session, how you, why you want to go next year without a plan, and why you're encouraging us to think further around what?
Yeah, because when the state legislators get up there and they blast cities saying, some cities, they get up there in the legislative sessions and they say, cities aren't taking the problem seriously. There are even cities that don't have a moderate housing plan, and then they call them out by name. I don't want to be one of those.
That's going to occur when?
January.
That's like a known thing to occur again?
Yes. It's the legislative session. It goes from January to March.
Correct.
45 days.
And this is the topic on during that session?
This, along with water, is probably going to be, are probably going to be the topics. And that's why I say, I would rather us adopt something tonight, because there's no December meeting. Adopt something tonight. Even if you're not 100% comfortable with it, we can bring it back in April after the legislative session, after they've done any, after they've approved any bills that associated with moderate housing, and revisit this.
And is the document was provided called Cedar Hills Moderate Housing Draft? Is that staff's version of what you're thinking we should be just copying that document itself?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Please, I'll speak
to Mike.
Please
speak to the
record.
State your name. Jenny Reese, Cedar Hills. I just wanted to add, and maybe Tom already said this and I was doing something else, but this has been a required part of code since 1996. We were supposed to have this done in 1996. It's 2018, but it's not like this is being rushed by the state. This is something that we were supposed to do 8 years ago. So, we're going to be fine.
It was part of 1996, but I don't know that we became a city until like 2002, so maybe only 16 years.
Still not being rushed.
Still not being rushed. No.
How does this goals document correlate with the draft document?
Just take the goals document, put it at the end. It's just they were drafted in two separate
documents. That's what that meant at the end of the.
Yeah.
So I read the other document at the end.
There's a sample page that
yes,
they give.
That.
Take that one out, put this one in.
Got it.
So, I really can't emphasize it enough, the emphasis that we put on moderate income housing at the state level.
So why don't we start with Eric.
You're Eric, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we start with you, and why don't you bring up any concerns, questions, anything you want to this body to consider, to discuss on this topic. Let's start. Now, Eric, this way.
Are you talking about the moderate income?
Yes, on this topic. Do you have any questions, comments, suggestions, ideas, critiques?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to compare the detail through the latest vision to this. If you had to summarize just one or two items that are different,
yeah, that's a good question. Class,
what would be that?
That's a really good question. Thanks for asking.
Pull the mic closer.
Really, no, really, no, the difference between the document. Sorry, let me split it up. The difference between the main document, putting the goals, policies, and objectives document aside for a second. The difference between the main document from last meeting to this meeting is simply a three-paragraph statement of the background of Cedar Hills information. The main document was put together by the Mountain Land Association of Government staff in conjunction with city staff. However, they don't live out here, they don't work out here, they don't deal with the problems and issues that we face on a day-to-day basis. Staff is well acquainted, with those. So we wanted to put on a personal touch and add some clearer verbiage related to what is currently facing Cedar Hills when it comes to moderate housing. So those issues I brought up, demographics, prices of homes in the area, and the unavailability of land are really the focal point of anything the city had.
So there were no changes to the existing verbiage, it was just a little addendum?
No, it's a brief section called Cedar Hills background.
Okay.
So I can read it? I can read it out loud if you'd like. I'll read it, so it'll be quick. It says, Cedar Hills background, moderate income housing means housing occupied or reserved for occupancy by households with a gross household income equal to or less than 80% of the median gross income for households of the same size in the county in which the city is located. In the following analysis, moderate income housing will be divided into three categories, 80%, 50%, 30% of the median gross income. According to the definition, the Utah County moderate income level is recommended to be used in assessing the affordability of housing in Cedar Hills. The average household size for Utah County was 3.6 persons in 2017, rounding to 4.0. For statistical purposes, this 2017 median gross income for a family of four in Utah County was $64,321. Therefore, an average household earning less than 80% or $51,456 of the Utah County median income is considered to be the standard by which Cedar Hills should assess the affordability of housing in the community. However, the use of the Utah County median income level does not adequately reflect current income levels in Cedar Hills. Therefore, various demographic data must be taken into consideration. Based on 2017 census data, Cedar Hills' median household income level was about 38% higher than the Utah County level. At 80% threshold, the median household income for Cedar Hills is $70,988, a difference of 38%. Naturally, higher levels of median household income reflect in higher average home values and prices on the housing market.
Thank you.
So the threshold of this state is going to view us on is how we compare, how our plan compares to the median income in the county.
Right.
Not our state.
The county is the standard, and that's why you have to really outline the demographic shift from the county average to the city average.
Did you have anything else, Eric?
No, that was it. Thank you.
All right.
Two comments for me. First one, relating to the single room occupancy.
Sure.
And something you said earlier about it's not as much where we are as where we're going.
Okay.
If we have very few reported with the city instances of single room occupancy. Is that what you call it?
Yes.
Single room occupancy. Even if there may be 50 of those, is it almost advantageous for us to then next year and the year following take steps to bring those to light and show that they're here?
Yes, they're already here.
Understood.
They're already here and they're not abundant. However, it's not something where it falls under the current definition of a family. When you move into the city, we don't require you to register with family. So it's something that's going to be very, very difficult to, given our current code, that's what I'm speaking of, our current code.
Right.
It's going to be very, very difficult to find out how many there actually are. Now, if we change the code, modify the code to require some sort of group home or group living arrangement registration with the city, much like we did with the accessory dwelling units, and I'm kind of speaking out of the code.
Sure.
Then you can at least know how many there are, or a better understanding. So yes, the problem does need to be addressed.
I think perhaps.
I would say there's a problem. That's probably the wrong word.
We might need the advice of a land use attorney on that. I don't know how it's going to be possible. Ask people living together in a home if they're married or not.
No. We would not. It's group living arrangements.
And you can, there are state codes that allow for you to dictate how group living arrangements are regulated within the community. Group living arrangements would be between individuals that are not related.
Are we worried about a report? Do we have to report a statistic or a number?
No, so that's why that's not, I wouldn't call it, I wouldn't call it as a less pressing issue.
It's in the plan as a permitted activity contributes towards the plan.
By simply by putting in the goals, policies, and objectives, we're stating that by allowing this, we're promoting a form of moderate income housing or moderate living arrangement, living arrangements that may not be allowed to a different community. But for example, a group home living arrangement would, let's say it was a detox center for alcoholics. They could come into the city and they could have four unrelated individuals moving into a home. And the city, we would approve it because it's the same as any other group living arrangement. And we would make them register, we would hopefully have code in place that would allow us to regulate them how we see fit.
Does this presume the landlord actually charges a rental rate that is moderate?
Well, to that end, if you're, let me get the right numbers. If moderate income housing with an average, if the average household income is 51,000, so let's say that you as an individual rent here and you make $51,000, if you're spending 30% of that on your living arrangement, that's affordable. So that would need to be a really nice room.
You have any else, John? Well, that leads to another comment that I have.
Sure. Sure.
So, hypothetically speaking, I had a neighbor who had a grandson and granddaughter-in-law who moved into her basement. It's not an accessory dwelling unit. There was not a separate. What if they weren't affected?
Different.
And it would be different. That'd be a group.
Be a group living arrangement in that case. But if it's family, if they're related, then it's.
Yeah, I know. The family thing always messes it up. But they were living there because it was affordable housing. Well, they paid rent and they did it because it was affordable.
And they can still do it that way as well. That individual could still register their accessory dwelling unit and rent it to family.
It wouldn't legally qualify as an ADU. There wasn't separate entrance for anything else. They didn't have to do the entrance out. So, okay. Second comment I had is, looking on the plan, looking forward, you're showing steps through, was it 2050? Something like that? Yes, through 2050. Can we make any assumptions at all about mass transit or anything else in the intervening 30 years?
And as a matter of record, that's Ethan Thomas, who could not attend the baby actually raised that up his topic.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he brought up
mass transit and having the city get more involved in encouraging or finding ways to get mass transit to work.
Sorry. I can talk about that just because I sit on the MAG board and they have their they have their transportation plan out to 2040 and they're working on the transportation plan out to 2050. And even out to 2050 for MAG's plan does not even show up as coming to materials. So they don't have any mass transit plans for this area.
So we can't make any assumptions there. All right. That's disappointing.
I've seen, to that point, I've seen the MAG projections on traffic on SRN2, North Cat Boulevard, on Canyon Road, and they don't change much over the course of the next 20 years just because there's not a lot of development that's going to happen out here. They're going to go up, but not as significantly as you're going to see I-15 number changes or State Street or State Street American Sport change.
Okay. Those were comments. All
right. Marie, would you have anything that does bring up?
I'm not sure. No, I think I was wondering about Goal 3.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking
for. Are there programs that can be used it says, you know, to consider utilization programs. Under the objectives, consider utilization of programs offered by the Utah Housing Corporation. Are there programs like that will fit within our community?
There are programs.
I mean, I know there's
how much they fit into our community. It's a big breakthrough because how much they fit into our community is very debatable because usually it's qualifying. It's like any grant or many grants, I should say, in that you qualify in that it's money that's intended to reach low income or very low income individuals and households where we just don't have that. Now, that's not to say that it's not worth the time to at least stay up on what those programs are or what they do. I think that there are a number of government programs that are available to municipalities, such as MAG being willing to help us with our moderate income housing plan and doing that pro bono. I wish this is something the city knew 16 years ago, but so it's I think it's still worth it for the city to be apprised of what is available. They may not always qualify, and I would say that, you know, in the vast majority of time they would not qualify.
Because usually there has to be something for someone to, a place for them to live, to qualify,
right,
to live in. Is that something we could promote throughout the community with our residents?
It could be, but my personal feelings are that that's probably very preliminary. It's a very new community, Cedar Hills. If you look at the average age of the homes, they're probably all less than 20, 25 years. The older parts of the home, the older parts of the city are still, I don't say they're not that old, man. You're still looking at late 70s for development. But as you look at that projection going out to 2030, 2040, eventually the city will reach an age where certain areas are good candidates for redevelopment. So at that point, that's where you maybe look at the demographics, what's changed in the city, and what programs are available for maybe redevelopment.
I was just wondering because we have something that some people want to stay,
yes,
including their children that are growing older.
And that's part of the problem is because it's not a place for them to stay. And then those that are very pricey.
That's another question I have.
Okay.
So, Jeff?
Nothing that is a part of this discussion.
Jared, did you have anything?
Just a couple questions. So the moderate income housing document becomes part of the city's general plan. Is that right? How it works?
Yeah, it becomes just its own element inside the general plan.
In your experience, what's the practical effect of that? I mean, who's going to look at that?
That is a very good question. And I think it's something the city should be doing better on. Quite frankly, the general plan is a document that Cedar Hills has drafted 20 plus years ago and put on a shelf. It's quite the dust. If you look at the established zones and the land use development, that's going to be a rule. That's once this is adopted, staff's focus shifts over to the land use development, which is the other requirement we have to have and desperately needs to be updated. But it should guide your land use decisions. The moderate income housing plan should be part of that discussion. So the state requires that we update this biennial. So every 2 years, we're going to have to resubmit this to the state for approval. But at that same time, as subdivisions come in and as redevelopment occurs, and that doesn't happen so much in Cedar Hills because we're teaching the community, but the policy, those policy objectives, the planning commission as well as the city council should be aware of what those are. And they're not, it's not code, it's not ordinances, but it should guide their decision making. And I feel like that's kind of where Cedar Hills has come up short in the last 20 years, in that they've drafted a general plan and really kind of just let it sit to the side and made large land use decisions outside of the scope of the general plan. So it should be something that kind of at a high level, at 35,000 feet level, dictates the decision making. Or guides the decision making, I should say, and you establish your codes, ordinances that dictate your decision making based on the policies established in the general plan. So that would be how ideally it would work.
So remind me of the history. So picking it off the dusting it off the ground. So there was a committee that the previous mayor put together to update the general plan.
Yeah.
Called the General Plan Committee. I was on that committee for a period of time. If I remember correctly, that committee dissolved that.
Yeah. And the purpose of that committee was to begin to take a pulse of the public. It wasn't necessarily to draft new documents.
Yeah.
And so the purpose of that committee, I felt like it reached its conclusion. We did the survey, which was responded to remarkably well. And I think that the results of that survey are still relevant in guiding the land use decisions and portions of the Monterey and housing amendments. So portions of that, those results from that study, were given to MAG and were incorporated into this Monterey and housing plan. So those, the work that they did has gone into this this draft element, and it will go into the draft element for land use as well.
That's, so the general plan is potentially one thing this body could potentially over time update if mayor and council wanted us to take a stab at that. That's what we're going to approve. This body can put it on the shelf.
There's three required elements. There's the housing, and then there's the land use element, which you establish what your city looks like, basically. And that's the next one I feel like needs a lot of attention. The third element that is required is the transportation element, and quite frankly, that one's not going to change a lot. I'm not as concerned about that one. Just because we've already established what where the major collector roads are, where the arterial roads are, and I don't foresee that one changing within the community. There are road projects that are going to go in, like the East-West Connector for the USDC land, that will change some of the transportation flows in the area, but that are not within city jurisdiction.
Anything else, Jared?
Do you have a feel for what our neighboring communities are doing with Alpine Highway? As far
very
as
similar to this, there's a lot of this language came from Alpine, and I feel like the communities here, they're kind of the same boat where they want to preserve a certain community feel. They like where they live, and there are certain reasons why they like where they live. So I think that there's certain things that these communities are starting to approach, ideas such as accessory dwelling units that they've been resistant to in the past, that are starting to become more palatable, especially in the communities like Highland and Alpine that have more land for development, rather than the state coming in saying, we're going to mandate that for every subdivision you approve, there's a portion of it that is moderate housing. They are proactive in that they approve accessory dwelling units or single room occupancy or their own goals, I don't know what it would be, but they promote it in their own way. So I would say that their promotion is going to be very similar to ours.
Does our city staff receive complaints about accessory dwelling units? Does that happen?
It happens, but typically it happens, Jenny says it better than I can, but typically it happens when it becomes a nuisance violation.
Like parking or what?
Parking. Typically noise is not one of them because they're typically owner-occupied, and so the owner can usually stand three times on the floor and quiet things down, but it's usually when it parks consistently in front of other people's homes. The bigger issue has always been rental dwellings where the owner's not present, because then you get the problem of the land not being kept in public property.
Like landscaping?
Landscaping, yeah. It's like they just don't mow the lawn, they just like go to weeds. They have a broken window, you don't get it fixed. Like that.
But there's enforcement
mechanism for that. Right. And that's a totally different scenario. And we do enforce that the best we can, given our staff and constraints.
I think the reason I asked that last question is because that's a big issue in trouble in some of the neighborhoods where you have sort of people renting illegal basement apartments and people have lived next door for 60 years and they hate it.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like that's really something we deal with here.
No, and I think that speaks a lot to the quality of the code that was passed in July on accessory dwelling units. Many of the issues that you see in terms of creating nuisances would be parking and just maybe the visual aspect of the home. I feel like that code did a really good job of outlining how they had to require certain parking requirements. Most neighbors don't really care what the inside of the house looks like as long as the outside, you want to be a good neighbor when you're lying. As long as the outside of the home does not have any negative or detrimental effects on their own property. So I feel like the code addressed that
very nicely to where we can enforce it as well. But also, I think, speaking of that code, I feel like it allowed a pathway for people that have accessory dwellings to register them and to make them comply with city code without it being cumbersome on their budget, on their structure of their home. I've heard very good things about it, so that's awesome.
Well, Provo went a long ways to the registration process. I mean, that was a big deal.
And they, yeah. And it was a big fight. It's probably a bigger fight in Provo, just given that it's a college town. So I did. As bad as our problem is, I'd say that theirs is exponentially worse.
But there's probably some examples that we could follow as far as how to enforce or implement a registration process.
Yeah. We'll be watching ours over time. I mean, it's still pretty new. It's only since maybe August that we've had an actual process coming in. We'll keep following that. If there's ways that we can tweak that, make it easier, streamline it, make it easier for people, we'll do so. There's already been a number of changes that we've made, not code-wise, but just application-wise, that have tried to streamline the process to make it quicker, make it a little easier to understand and give them.
So before I take a turn, did anybody else have anything else I want to bring up? Is it a thought of this? So here's a few questions and thoughts I had. So in the goal document, probably. In the first paragraph, I think we should strike a sentence, there are the sentence. I don't see any reason why we should memorialize the recent settlement agreement in this document. We talked about how, however, in a recent settlement agreement, because we used to be seeking a land developer, I don't know why we memorialize that little piece of history in this document. We could strike that language and just state something that, you know, a home land subdivision.
We could reword that to make no reference to a settlement agreement, but I think the point of making that is that
the point you're making, I agree with the point, I'm just saying that.
The point is just saying, look, our biggest development is an 80 unit subdivision, whereas Harriman, West Jordan, these other communities, if you're looking at that, it's how many times more?
Right. So yeah, I just would strike reference to the myself.
Okay. I don't know.
And then in the goals, I like a little softer language versus I'll just consider strict language. For example, goal 2, it says allow for housing in commercial and mixed use zones. So once we use the word allow,
we already do.
So I would say the goal should be considered allowed.
We already allowed.
Yeah, it's already allowed.
That's why it's not.
Well, let me get to that point. I feel like we've already used a big chunk of our commercial zone for residential use.
Yeah.
I hate to see the remaining commercial zone we have come into residential. So I'm kind of opposed to, as a goal, allowing additional housing in our commercial zone.
Well,
we already know. So I'm just saying, once we, I mean, that's my concern.
But then it's already zoned that way.
I know our zoning allows for it.
There's still one parcel that you could, in theory, do mixed-use development. It's the one with the 80, with Cedar Canyon approved. That one took the bulk of it. It's
sure.
It's the piece that's behind Walmart on the corner there.
Yeah.
That's right. That's it. So, while when the code was drafted to allow for a residential element in the commercial zone, I just don't foresee that happening.
So why is it a goal then?
Because the state wants to know what we're doing and what we've done. That's something we've done.
Okay. So
that policy needs to be struck. That's in the wrongs.
What's that?
Policy in rule 2.
That was unit 3, yeah.
Yeah, I'll just put the last one.
On goal 3, I have no knowledge of what these programs are, but we really want to use them. I guess I don't have to change that. I mean, I can fully post, but I have no idea, but I'm not going to discuss it. But goal 4, allow for single room occupancy. So I'd rather say consider allowing
for single room occupancy versus stadium it's allowed, period. And I know we have the accessory apartment language that we just adopted. And during that discussion, we talked about, you know, need for a separate address and utility and safety elements and things like that. And the way this reads to me is that now we can have, if I have a 5-bedroom house, I can rent 4 of the bedrooms to 4 different people.
You can rent 3 of them.
They could have anything there. Technically, same address, but, you know, 911 call, what bedroom they can go to, who knows. I just, I'm really personally opposed to expanding, turning into our homes or to mini hotels, if you will. That's my concern around single room occupancy, or am I missing something here, or are we? So your accessory units is basically, you know, a portion of your house, you've got a separate address, a separate entrance.
Well, you wouldn't address a room in your house. Obviously, we do that. And if there's a 911 call made to the home, I don't know if it would be too hard to just go where the call came from if it's just single room occupancy. So the public safety aspect, I don't feel like necessarily translated from the same concerns we have for accessory dwelling units to single room occupancy. But like I said, we already allow for group living arrangements. And that's why it says allow for single room occupancy. It's worded differently. And my recommendation would be to still consider drafting code related to single room occupancy and group living arrangements.
That's my suggestion. We have to consider to that goal instead of we are now allowing single room occupancy. Right now it just says allow single room occupancy.
Well, and then consider allow. Hey, this is a goal. This is not a plan.
But once you put language, this is going to become a you know, a document adopted by city councils, going to be the general plan. And a lot of the way you're referring to these things is keeping them in there.
That's what I'm going to ask you. Are you concerned that they would, developer comes in and says, in accordance with one of your city's goals, I would like to propose a change to blah, blah, blah that allows.
He can do that, but he can't come in with a development that shows many hotels and say, well, your general plan has a goal for allowing for single room occupancy. His application still has to apply the city code.
So I think what we're trying to let the state know.
Yeah, we're trying to let the state know what policies, what actions we're going to be taking, or the policies
we're going to be
taking. Or have already taken. So in this case, why it's drafted the way it is because in my reading of the code is we already allow for it. What we would need to do is to flesh that out a little bit clearer so that when people are making an application for group living arrangements, there's specific criteria rather than a reach code or a family code and say, okay, there's 4 related individuals.
Do we need to add words to that effect to these goals? I'm just trying to sort of mediate here.
I mean, no, we can do that. That's where maybe.
Confines of existing zoning and whatever.
Well, maybe rather than, maybe this may resolve some of these concerns. Right now it says allow for single room occupancy. Nowhere in our code does it say single room occupancy. If it changed to allow for group living arrangements and then objectives to evaluate the necessary to promote single room occupancy as a means to develop more modern housing senior housing. We already allow for group living arrangements.
I'd be more comfortable with that language.
Okay.
So you know, I think there's any definition you have. You don't know what is that, right?
And I don't want to seem like I'm reluctant to change anything. I just want to justify why it says what it says.
Now, the word under objectives promote. Is it the city's role to promote?
I think the state's saying that it is.
Yeah.
The state's saying we have to promote modern income housing. So,
well, we have to have a plan. We don't have to promote a plan.
I think that's why it says if necessary.
We don't have to plan.
I don't want to promote it.
Right.
I don't want to promote it. That's why I think it says to evaluate and if necessary promote it so long as they're locking it safely.
And why would it be necessary? Because we're not meeting
goals, but.
Yeah. So I have state, the state says they're raising the number of moderate income housing units that are to be found in the city. And then we looked at it and said, okay, well, there's not a lot of ADUs that can be had. Let's tell people about group living arrangements.
So under the objectives, I'd also strike the single room occupancy and refer to group living arrangements as well. So, goal four.
To go, say that again.
And goal four objectives, we mentioned single room occupancy again, and I would just change that to the goal two. That would be allow for group living arrangements. So it'd be promote group living arrangements.
I don't know that substantially changes anything.
Well, we'd have a definition for what a single room occupancy is, so I'm a little bit nervous about creating a general plan without definition. We could create a definition, I suppose, but
not
that. It's tough, right?
Yeah. So I see where you're going. So we can call it out as group living or group living arrangements, just given that we have a family definition as for individuals. But I think the whole idea of this is that we allow for group living arrangements. Like I said, in the next year, I would anticipate that we will see staff drafting something on single room occupancy.
The group living arrangements, remind me, is owner occupied homes.
Correct. So you're one of those. So you're the three people.
All right. So those are my comments on goal four.
Or limited individuals, excuse me. Okay, sorry.
Under policies on the next page, again, we cite the reference single room occupancy opening. Policies.
But I think that one is future tense. That one is to begin discussions with planning discussion with planning commission city council as well, or some more occupancy. That is what we want to do.
Okay. Those are the one comments on that document, just jump over to the other one.
Okay.
I'm assuming all the numbers and data are correct, so
just,
it's...
Those are kind of, they are where they are.
What, going to Stephen Thomas's comments about mass transit, the fact that we're not apparently within the radar for another 40 years, whatever, 30 years. And Jenny, you sit on a what committee?
MAC, it's the Metropolitan Planning Organization for Utah Savannah.
So, is the reason we're not on a blip on the radar, if you will, because Highland Outline knows how to approach UTA, or is it just we don't have just our studies just don't?
I would say that my biggest thing would be that there should be approached communities, these three communities, Lone Peak area has not approached UTA because there has not been demand.
Any other comments or questions on this topic?
And that's not to say that cannot be a policy that the city does work with UTA and quality transportation opportunities throughout the community that can very be a goal.
On the UTA, I actually have talked to UTA and MAG. They spend a lot of time doing quite a few extensive studies with UTA and with UDOT and with the counties and with the state when they come up with their transportation plan. And basically, what they're focusing on right now is building transportation corridors along that I-15 and where all the growth is happening. And it's not happening this far or east. So that is why we're not on their radar right now. There was a discussion I had with UTA because they're really trying to push for the counties to implement that additional 40% sales tax, which would go, it's a 40-20 split. 40% would go to UTA, 40% would go to the county, 20% would go to cities. And if the county doesn't approve that, then 2021, I think, it comes to the cities, and the cities can decide to implement it on their own. And then it's a 50-50 split between the cities and UTA. And I asked UTA, what would be the benefit to a community like ours to give you 50%? I mean, 50% for our roads would be great, but what would that 50% do for us that's going to UTA? And their response to that was they would be willing to work with the cities to offer transportation that's not on the master transportation list, so that might be bound pools or those kinds of mechanisms to get to mass transit, but all of their studies just don't show the growth happening out here. It's happening in Vineyard, Lehigh, American Fork, and Pleasant Grove, and you can see that. You can see where all of that density is going. That's where their focus is right now, is to put it where there is the mixed-use living arrangements and all densities going in. And the other thing I wanted to add is on the section where you asked about memorializing the settlement, I will strongly recommend to the council that we keep that in. And the reason why is I work with the legislators quite a bit. That there is this mentality right now, the state legislature, that every city needs to do their fair share. And what that looks like to the legislature is every city should have a percentage of affordable housing. And the pushback that we are as cities trying to the conversation we're trying to have with the legislators is that doesn't make sense, because what I can do in Cedar Hills is very different from what Harriman can do, because they have more land available. They're near transportation corridors. They're near, or Lehigh, they're near employment centers. And we're never going to be that. And so if you're trying to say that I've got to figure out 250 homes in Cedar Hills that are affordable housing, I can't do that. You're tying my hands and asking me to do something that I can't comply with. But what I can do is show them the things that we are doing. And one of the things that we have shown is we took a big section of our SC1 zone and we rezoned it into a PD1 zone and allowed for mostly just residential. But if you look at our zoning map now, it just shows it's a PD1 zone. They don't know it was an SC1 zone. And so that history is gone, where we can say we have rezoned portions of our city to allow for higher density or to allow for more residential. These are small lots. But again, that story has to be told somewhere. They don't know. They just can just assume we've always had it as a PD1 residential zone. They don't know we took 11 acres of our SC1 zone and converted it. So I need to have that story to tell them when they're pushing on us, what have you done or what are you doing? Those are the stories that we want to tell. And then the other thing is when Chandler talked about the single occupancy, ULCT is trying to have this conversation with the state saying, one size fits all is not going to work. So you can't say every city needs to have 10% affordable housing or every city needs to have a percentage of low income housing. You can't treat all cities the same. We all have unique challenges and resources and what we can do. Instead, what you should do is say, here are 10 ways that you can help us with the affordable housing crisis. Pick three. And our three are going to maybe be ADUs and single occupancy rentals and rezoning that PD1 zone. But what we're trying to show the state is there are things that we can do. It might not be what Salt Lake's doing or what Lehigh's doing. Give us some flexibility there. Let us figure out how it works for our community. And that's where we're trying to show a variety of options and ways we can meet it. Because if we just go back to the state and say, we can't do it, they don't accept that as an answer. So the 1.7% that we're being penalized this year, it actually was only assessed to cities that didn't have a certain percentage of affordable housing. That's why we're paying it. Salt Lake City's not paying it. And you know, and they don't have, well, they have, but there are other cities. West Valley is not paying it, and they do not have a homeless shelter in their city. But they have a high amount of affordable or low-income housing. So we're trying to push back and say, quit penalizing us for market conditions that are outside of our control, and our ADUs aren't moderate, you know, if they're not affordable housing, or we don't have mass transit here, or we don't have an employment center. We can do these three things. Help us acknowledge that that's acceptable to you, because we're trying. It's just not going to be the same as what every other city's doing. So that's the story that we're trying to tell. And as Chandler mentioned, in January, the legislative session, we know we're gonna get hit pretty hard. The state is very concerned about making housing affordable in Utah. And if we don't have a compromise with them, they're gonna force it on us. And it's not gonna be something that we can do without just paying penalties, which we can't afford to do. So that is why I asked Chandler to put that in there, so we have that story to tell, whether it's now or 10 years from now. They can see the things that we tried to accomplish.
So this body just reviews the recommends anyway, so certainly you're all going to have that link. And I'm not, and I want you to be able to tell your story, so I'm not opposed to that. I would suggest maybe saying a recent settlement, maybe we put from a 2018 settlement agreement, put a date on there.
Can I add one thing to that as well, that maybe we could spell out in the document, is that we rezoned this as a native home subdivision, but we don't need to dictate the market conditions. Not a single one is needing to alter the affordable. That's just the way it is.
But it shows we did our part. We're allowing for small lots.
And if that's part of the story, we should expand this language here to elaborate that further. I would suspect
you have
to indicate that.
Yeah, I'm just at this point, just given that they're not on the market, they're not under development right now, so that might be something that gets added in.
If you want to make a motion on any of the this sort of, I think the only changes I think you suggested the body has what would happen.
Do you want to list the ones I can bring down?
Sure.
To the old fossil procedures document, I have changed from recent to 2018. Goal 2, there's a policy there that needs to be struck through. And then on Goal 4, change the goal and objective, change single room occupancy to group living arrangements while leaving single room occupancy under policy. Is that document?
Do you want to cite the code that I have in front of me for single room for a group living in the goal?
We can.
I don't know what that is, but we can cite
it's 10-2.
Should I cite that? Why not?
Because it could change, the number it could change.
And then we have to, by necessity, change the plan.
It's implied that it has to comply with the ordinance.
Your thoughts?
I think for referencing something in the code is a goal or objective, or referencing that, we should include the code first. Otherwise, the public has to go hunting for it. It's a matter of.
Well, I mean, we do it in Goal 1. We do the same thing where we have an accessory dwelling units.
Yeah, we don't have this out there.
We easily could. And
we're using terms that are
Maybe you can reference that further definitions and further explanations of the serial municipal code, blanket state. I do try to leave state references out of city code just because those change all the time and you just never can keep up. So it is something that you have a little more control over it, your own code. That was from that document. The other document, I don't know that I have any changes that were recommended. I may flesh out some more in that red section that I read to you. I may add some language discussing the topography of cedar hills and the difficulty to go out.
You're welcome to make a motion if you'd like. Okay, that's fine.
I'm thinking Jeff should make.
So I make a motion that we recommend the City Council the proposed moderate income housing element for adoption as part of the Cedar Hills general plan, subject to the changes Chandler just mentioned.
Second.
Any discussion before we vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. And next topic. The next topic on the agenda is review, recommendation, and a public hearing on amendments to City Code Title 10, Chapter 520, related to carports, land, sea cargo containers, and accessory structures. I think I would like to open with a public hearing first. given the volume of the public that's here. So I'm now opening the public hearing on amendments to City Code Title 10, Chapter 5.9, related to cardboard, land use, public containers, and accessory structures. Is there anybody here in the public who would like to give public comment in this public hearing? So you have 3 minutes to speak to the topic. Seeing none, I now close the public hearing on amendments to City Code Title 10, Chapter 5.9, related to cardboard, fence, and cardboard containers, and accessory structures. Thank you. State your name, before you pass it.
I'm Jenny Kay. I am on the staff of Cedar Hills. So one of the things I'm going to be addressing is the recommended proposed addition to codes relating to carports, landscape, carports, containers, and accessory structures. Staff is seeking Planning Commission to review and recommend these changes in addition to these to allow for changes to the code that would the terminology include terms defined and modified in order to reflect these changes as well. So I'd like to begin with the current carport in Cedar Hills that we have currently. As far as I'm aware of, that we don't have any current permits for these property owners that have obtained for these carports. Again, most of these have been placed throughout the city within Cedar Hills throughout the years. In the past, probably a year and a half, we have received several requests for these prefab type carports within the city for residents for these type of structures. Most of these, or all of them, have failed to meet building permit and through the zoning and through the building department, and we've had to deny these permits. Currently, right now in our code, the only thing that we have is a term is defined for carport, but it fails in our code to further describe anything such as if we would prohibit or allow these type of structures. So in our code, 10.5.29, as it relates to decks, porches, patios, pergolas, awnings, hot tubs, and other similar structures, in this portion of the code, 3, prior to construction, a building permit shall be obtained for all structures. And A, prior to issuing a building permit, the chief building official shall make a finding whether the materials finishing and the proposed structure are in harmony with the primary structure and the surrounding as a whole, and issue a permit with a positive finding. B, temporary structures. These three aspects of the code is where it becomes a conflict with the building department and zoning department to be able to even consider these as structures in the past. Now, I've spoken with our building official on multiple occasions on this issue, and these questions constantly come up. And be aware that I'm strictly addressing the prefab type of structures that come out. These are the ones that you can currently buy at any of these stores. They're the prefab ones. They typically don't have engineering on these. This is from the building perspective. He would consider these as typically a portable type garage. They're easily removable. They don't meet structural requirements such as seismic, wind, personal capacity. Typically, they don't meet the IRC building code requirements, fire rating, the location requirement on the property would also play a factor as far as the building requirements. This would also play a factor as far as the, fire rating on that, depending on how close it is to the main building or to the property line. This also becomes a factor. Typically, carports are typically entirely of metal, So the materials and the finish would not be the same as the main structure. So as per this code, this is impossible for the building official to approve if it does not meet the intent of our current code due to these reasons. From the zoning perspective, this would also be a no for me to be able to approve it because there is no code that substantiates and addresses carports. This is under 10.529 on the B that addresses temporary structures. Again, that's what we come up with portable type garages. So this is where we're at, and we come to this as far as we want to revamp or include carports. So as we move forward in the proposed additions, we want to include carports in our 10.529 in the decks, patios, and pergolas, that section. We feel comfortable in putting that in this section. So under section A, under one, we included carports may only be used for the parking and storage of vehicles and or recreational vehicles. Now the reason why I placed that in there was due to the fact that the question did come up on the last planning commission. Well, what if we decided to use our carport to store junk? Would it be foreseeable from street junk being placed? So we wanted to have a purpose for this carports. So in this, essentially, we wanted a function for carports in the code. That was placed in there. As far as the structure being converted into living room space, that stayed the same prior to construction. It needed a building permit. That did not change. The problem that we did come to is under 3A. This was a section that we did have a lot of debate about. This is where I do need staff. As a staff member, I do need additional feedback from the Planning Commission for this. So in this, we did add design, material, and finish. I'm not happy with this section of this as far as the chief building official, and he, frankly, when speaking with him, he's not thrilled with this aspect of the code as well for these reasons. In this, when I included the word attached structure, this would call out for awnings. It wouldn't call out for carports. So when a design goes out to look at a carport, this would essentially be for the building official. Where it comes out as a carport, carports are typically made out of metal. So the design, finish, and color, this wouldn't apply to as a carport type structure. So this is where the language needs to be a little bit clarification on this. And this is what I'm asking you for a little bit clarification on this.
So may I suggest we have the carports versus the storage containers? That room storage containers as well.
Yes, we are.
So let's talk. There's kind of different documents, right? So we can.
Yeah, and we're
going to
address that a little bit later
down
in the.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start over here. Jared, did you have anything you'd like to bring up on this topic?
I expressed my opinion last time that I think that the. The language which requires the design materials and finish of the proposed attached structure be in harmony with the primary structure. I think that's a good.
Can I speak to that for just a second? I think you have to differentiate between, and I think Jared's right, is that when it's attached to the structure, it's very easy to determine when it is in harmony with the home. And I've emailed you some pictures that Jenny took of some awnings that are found throughout the community and some carports. two of them bounced back. So Jared and Jeff, I need to send that to you again. Your emails did not like the size of the email I sent you. But you can look at those and see what harmony means. I think it's very clear when, so I shouldn't say very clear, but it's to a rational human, it should be very understandable what is meant by harmony and when those materials are harmonious and it's attached to the structure. A carport, on the other hand, is going to be very difficult to make it harmonious with a structure unless you are living in a metal full barn. So I think that's where you have to differentiate. The harmony is with those that are attached to the main dwelling.
So if I understand it, and I agree with Jared, right now our code doesn't allow for these metal carports, so it can't comply with our current code. We're considering language that would allow metal carports to be introduced to various properties around the city. And in order to make them permissible, we have to let go of the idea that they should harmonize with the primary structure, whether they're attached or detached,
right?
In order for them to be permissible, and I guess that begs a question for me, and maybe for others, why would we want to do that? Why would we let go of that requirement? Do we not like the way our code is written currently so that residents are not allowed to erect these metal detached structures somewhere on the property within certain items, and we don't want that?
Just to clarify, it's not scheduled. It's not permitted or not.
We just don't have clarification in our code that says either we do or we do not.
Right, I understood that we already have it defined. We have what a carport is. We don't say whether we like them or not or allow them or not. So we're trying to write the code, essentially recommend that we allow it, but in order for that to take place, we have to let go of certain aesthetic requirements.
Correct.
And so I'm asking myself, do I love it? Do I like it the way it is? Am I denying somebody their rights at the same time? So that's kind of thinking.
So you've added the word attached.
I have added the word attached.
So I didn't see the pictures, but are these prefab metal structures attached?
No.
No, these would all be detached carports.
So what's wrong with this language as it currently is proposed?
That's for the body to decide.
Because if this were to be considered a proposed structure as is, then our building official, the detached carports would have to meet the materials finished as the same dwelling would have to match.
Well, I'm confused because I think that's why we added
attached. I think by adding attached, we've kind of separated the issues, though.
We've divided the two.
Right. So we've taken on the awning that is attached to the home, that you can't just put corrugated metal onto the home and call it an awning. It has to blend in with the home and look synonymous. Whereas a carport's a carport. We know one when we see one. And they're not attached. And so I think that, Jenny, I think you've done a good job of calling out the difference in that. By adding the word attached, we're not saying that the carport has to be harmonious. I think that's what Jeff's getting at, is that as a planning commission, as a city council, how do you feel about a carport, knowing that it does not look like the main dwelling? Really, that's what it comes down to.
It will be completely different.
So to clarify, so I understand, kind of repeating back to you, we've added the word attached so that we're distinguishing between a structure that's attached to the primary structure and leaving the aesthetic requirement there in that instance, as opposed to a detached item such as a carport.
Right, which is covered in Section 6.
What we're proposing would be covered as a temporary structure.
No.
So we maybe this can be clarified just in B. If you go in B, it just says the structure. If you strike out the and add an accessory structure, where we define an accessory structure and it's not attached to the building. So you have code that is for an attached awning or a deck versus an accessory structure, which would be clearly not attached to the building, which would be a carport, a pergola. What else do we have on here? Patios yeah, could go one way or another. Say it again? Why would that be?
Why wouldn't it be?
No, I think we should add that. I think that under B, right under A where it says attached, the next section B, it says the structure. I think for clarity's sake, an accessory structure, which we call out a definition for, we treat it differently. We call it out here that we're treating it differently. We're treating it differently. Jenny's going to propose that we treat it differently setback-wise, but also aesthetic-wise. But specifically carports, and that's maybe where we are going to get into some mud here, is that most accessory dwellings, like if you're building an outbound garage, the materials should match the dwelling, except for a carport. I mean, there's just no way around that. If you're going to allow a carport, are you going to make them put the metal frame up and then put brick and then shingles on top? Because then it's...
Okay, but I've got an accessory structure on my property.
What's your accessory? What's your accessory structure?
It's a shed.
We call it out in a different section. 10.5.28. Sheds are treated by themselves.
Completely separate.
Okay. And yes, we don't require your shed to have stucco.
That's perfect.
So I don't know, that's where you're going to get into situations. By putting all of these under the same code, you're going to get into some murky water trying to treat them all separately but equally, but it's not that simple.
I have. So, we'll see up here. Anything else? Jeff.
Nothing but the TV.
Well, all right.
One thing, I don't know if the Planning Commission saw this already, but staff's recommendation is that this gets tabled tonight. And we did the review recommendation. Speaking with Jenny, I felt like it was important that we get this right rather than try to rush something through that we're not comfortable with. And so where there were totally not comfortable with what we're proposing, and there's still some vagaries we'd like some clarification on, I strongly feel like it should be tabled.
We'll see what happens. Maybe we won't be uncomfortable.
So three, do you have any more
questions? Yes, on the 3A, where we're not talking about carports, where we're talking about attached, I like adding attached there and having that applied to the attached structures. I don't think there needs to be additional information in that paragraph. I'm actually comfortable with it, I think, from the examples the chamber sent.
Did you see them? I may have. I forget what I do sometimes.
Let me send them in Dropbox.
Okay, do we put them in Dropbox?
If you didn't give them to me,
I'll have to make sure everyone gets them.
I did not get any in the last 5 days.
Okay.
But I think that's okay.
I'm going to have to, since we're on this topic.
Sure.
This paragraph. So when we say and the surroundings as a whole, I don't really know. It means it looks good by this tree over here, that over there there's no bushes. No. I don't know what surrounding as a whole means. So I would prefer maybe to strike the surrounding as a whole and just talk about the primary structure. I think when you add that, that's kind of vagueness of
probably sufficient
surrounding as a whole, I don't know what that means. We're going to tap with it, right?
Yeah, how big is whole?
Whole community.
Yeah. So. Okay. And then pertaining to the carports themselves, further down in section 6, we haven't really discussed that a lot yet. I've been looking at the documents you set here with the way the descriptions are.
Okay, are you looking at?
I'm looking at these.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about the setback document?
Okay. So,
setbacks.
Let's talk about setbacks.
A little exciting topic. It's really not exciting, but it's really important.
It could be exciting.
This is exciting.
I think yours bouncing back.
It kind of is. Yes, I definitely have some questions about setbacks.
Okay. So on these setbacks, Okay, so if we did allow these open type structures or carports, we're going to call these out as carports, but would it be reasonable assumption to place them in the same category as an accessory building or accessory structure? They would meet the same conditions as that in each zone. So in each zone, say I'm going to take, for example, R115 as a residential zone. The setback from the main building shall be not less than 12 feet from the rear of the closest rear of the main building, and not less than 12 feet from the closest sidewall of the main building. Now, if you go read down a little bit further, it says accessory buildings that are located 12 feet or closer to the main building shall be considered part of the main building. So if you look at my examples on the first one, this would be a corner lot. So let's call that a corner lot. So the first example is it would have to be 30 feet from the side lot line that abuts the street, and it could be 5 feet from the rear or side lot line. So this would be for, say, the side-loading garage. Now, it wouldn't be able to be in front of a side-loading garage if it was set back further onto the property, say, 40 feet, and it was a 10-foot on your, carport. It could be in front of that side-loading garage. It could be to the side of it, but not in front of it on that side setback.
You're just pulling straight from accessory structures.
This is straight from accessory structures. Okay, and this is if it's outside the building envelope. So we would need those requirements.
I think we can save you some time. Does anybody in this body oppose the use of the accessory structure setback code for the service carports?
I do.
Okay. From setbacks.
From setback standpoint.
It's more just setbacks, so it's height.
Right.
There are size.
There are other.
We're talking about setbacks right now.
Right.
So if we can find a lot of setbacks.
So now if it is closer than the 12 feet, it becomes within the building envelope.
And then the aesthetic applies.
It starts
not necessarily.
Or it also
does it behave attached?
It does not behave as attached.
The 12 foot requirement is for fire code. Anything within 12 feet needs to be fire rated because if the main dwelling's on fire, then anything within 12 feet of it is also likely to be on fire.
So it's not a permitted activity to have it closer than 12 feet unless it's attached.
It may be closer than 12 feet. I did speak with the building official regarding this. They would allow it closer than the 12 feet, but it would have to be within the building setbacks at that time. If you look under the location requirements for the main building, it said all main building and other dwelling buildings and structures that would be considered a structure shall be set back according to the following. So it would have to be within the setback requirements. The problem is when you get into that category, the closer you get to the main building, the more expensive that building becomes. You then have to meet those building requirements. Your fire rating goes up, everything goes up on that, because when you submit your plans to that building requirement, you have to meet those requirements.
So then it becomes part of what has to fit within.
There's that fire rating, that wall separation on the exterior wall, you have to meet those requirements.
Well, then the setbacks and everything else has to be. Now that it's within 12 feet, it's considered part of the main building.
It's considered part of the main building.
So on the third drawing that you've got here, you show that.
I do. On that third drawing. And the same as if the property, the closer you get to that property, side property, and that's what I wanted to stick to the accessory 5 foot to the property line, because the closer you get to that property line, you still have that fire restriction. You have to meet those fire codes. Yeah. So if you stick with the with those accessory structures, you technically need to avoid that.
Anything else, John? No. Not with pertaining to setback. What about cardboard containers? Sorry, cardboards. No. Yeah, cardboards in general. Height, elevation is what I'm
I think Jared has
accessory building requirements.
Okay, so on these height elevations, the elevation must not exceed the main dwelling elevation. The extent of the structure shall not exceed one story. It should not extend above the roof line of the existing residential structure. So basically, they can't go over one story here. The maximum of an accessory structure is 20 feet or 25 feet, I believe, on, is it Chandler?
It's 20 feet for an accessory structure in the R1 20,000 zone. It can go up to 25 feet if it meets certain setbacks.
Thank you.
So I will say that that height restriction probably will eliminate the use of these for recreational vehicles in large measure, because someone's RV fairly tall, maybe equal height or even higher potentially or equal height to the single story home, and you want your carport to be higher than your RV, obviously, otherwise you're going to crash in that parking, right? So something to consider, right? I think that's one of the primary uses of these carports is for people to get their creative RVs, their buses, their cabin, whatever, we can call recreational vehicles. So that's something we should maybe talk about with it.
It's tough because you don't have any recreational vehicles, so you probably have more vehicles. Use it with a vehicle under overpasses. Problem is not the height of the vehicle, it's that you have to have a little higher pitch roof. It's got to be higher because at the low end of the corners is where it's going to go. Because I do have a problem with these being taller than your primary structure.
But you could eliminate, so in 6.4, the second sentence, well, the first sentence says it must not exceed the main dwelling elevation. To John's point, and I agree with that. Then it says the extended structure shall not exceed one story. But then it goes on to say, shall not extend above the roof line of the existing residential structure. If the existing residential structure is two-story tall, it's not going to exceed that. So I'm not sure why we're limiting it to one story.
There's some stairs that are two-story.
I haven't seen one.
Seen one.
I have not seen one. But at the same
so,
time,
homes that are two stories get their RV stored, and those that don't.
You could have a height requirement that has to be met or can't be exceeded, and then I'm sympathetic to John's point about how the nature of the pitch works.
Yeah.
But you can easily flatten out the pitch. We're not making any pitch requirements. It doesn't have to be a steep pitch. As long as it's engineered for a snow load to drain off. I mean, you could have a relatively flat pitch and have a 20-foot requirement. I'm just throwing out 20 feet. And still park that RV quite comfortably under there, given a flat pitch. That's up to the individual to design, not the city.
I'm not an RV enthusiast or expert here. I don't really know how tall these things.
But if you think about overpasses that you drive under, what do the signs say? They don't say 20 feet. They usually say like 17.
Yeah.
20 feet, I feel like, is very generous.
Well, I think if you go, I mean, if it's a single story home and we are talking about having something twice as tall, now it's not in harmony with the
structure. Say that again. Say that again.
There's the harmony part too, right?
It's not attached.
But a detached carport that is taller than the main dwelling is not really harmony with the main dwelling. Okay. So, you have a house here, carport,
it looks
over
here.
You're right. It would look goofy. In that case, they'd probably just have to build an additional garage as part of their home rather than a carport or an awning.
It's a really big awning or garage.
All right, I don't have a problem with the way the language is written. I'm just pointing out the fact that I think there will be a segment of our city that probably will be able to take advantage of carports.
True. There's segments of this, that goes with every code, is that not everyone can do anything.
Yeah.
But I'm still not sure that one story serves any purpose.
I'm actually with Commissioner Anderson on that. The carport elevation must not exceed the main dwelling elevation. I think that stands alone to me. And I actually, aesthetically, think that's important.
But
then do you add a...
If we allow it not exceeding the dwelling in a two-story, very tall house, we're creating a really tall carport.
That's why I say I think you should have a height requirement or a height limitation.
Yeah.
You have to have something to put a cap on it. Say that again.
What's the 20
feet?
20 feet for accessory structures.
No, 20 feet at top pitch.
We want to call out the language for that 20 feet for accessory
structures.
I would say such important to say carport elevations must not exceed either say
the drive by
accessory code or accessory structure.
It's got an RV
height.
That's what
point is that?
Do you, or we put a number on it, or do you reference accessory structure?
So if you're going straight down from
we reference
the white church,
structure, or
Indian church,
due
south.
Tall carport setting.
This
is good.
I think they're less heat, so if you got two story houses.
We're arbitrarily
picking up. I think it's really good if it's a one story house and then you guys can
see. Oh, yeah. Super. But 20 feet's not.
20 feet's high.
20 feet's high, and it's not. I don't know that it's arbitrary.
Yes.
All right, so 20 feet. What's
not
as 20 feet?
Not as a basketball hoop is 10 feet. Come
I
on.
Think everybody's agreeing with 20 feet, right?
Yeah, 20 feet. Yeah, 20 feet.
Fine.
Is
okay.
Plenty tall.
All right.
Okay. What about section 2 on total width of the carport on sites that actually might exceed 24 feet? Is that too expansive, or do we want to reduce that into a reasonable?
To give you some perspective, that's two parking stalls and 4 feet to get in and out.
I don't have a problem with 4 feet. I'm actually okay with that.
If you want side by each,
we want to apply that to carports. I'll set that very much to the size of that. Is it defining width period, regardless of whether it be?
The code, the backyard code actually kind of already has a formula that dictates how big it can be. You have to have at least 50% of your yard open for landscaping, which leaves for a very, very wide carport.
Yeah.
So if you we don't limit other accessory structures in width wise. So it's up to this body.
Anything else, Tom?
No, that's what I have. Although I actually kind of agree with you on number two there. I don't know why we're limiting that in side setback. You still have to meet all your other setbacks and restrictions on land usage, so.
You say the total width of a carport shall not exceed 24 feet.
Yeah, we talked about this last month a little bit, and I think that, because my memory is that there's a difference in how it looks on the side as opposed to the back. And it's in the back, you don't care, it's wider. That's the way
it is. Yeah. So this is for the purpose of storing automobiles and recreational vehicles. So 24 feet wide, for that purpose.
You want to leave it out?
So, I suggest we say the total width of the carport.
Oh no!
So not exceed 24 feet.
I understand what you're saying. He's saying maybe it can be wider than that at the back, not the side entry.
Yeah.
24. So we're only limiting it if it's a side.
If it's a side.
Yeah, I understand. Square. Yes, you may.
again, sorry, I apologize. I don't know this to my client, hoping correctly will say well tonight. With this being an accessory structure, is it required to meet all other building code requirements in terms of wind?
Yeah, so they would have to provide engineering as part of their building submittal, showing a snow load, showing a wind capacity, showing any seismic requirements that building code requires.
Let's see, 5 feet is a lot.
It's
could be a house right there.
It's for any building over 200 square feet. So if they had one that was under 200 square feet, they wouldn't have to meet those. But anything we determine 200 square feet is the threshold.
That's fine. So I had a couple of things here. The very opening carport definition. We talked about structure not to be by the walls, which are the walls. I was suggesting we strike automobiles and use the same thing that we do down under 10.59A1 and use carport, the storage of vehicles and our recreational vehicles. So that's the change in definition, strike automobiles and add storage of vehicles and our recreational vehicles.
I like that.
And then down in section 6, so, portable garages or canopies are prohibited in all residential zones. So, we don't have the definition for portable garage, right? Or a canopy. Yeah. What's considered a canopy?
Canopy is just a canvas covered building.
A canvas covered building is a canopy?
Yeah, it's a canopy.
Okay. So that's.
We use that term to mean a whole lot of.
Okay. If we need to define that, then we can.
Some people call their awning a canopy.
Right. We call main entries big buildings.
We can strike out canopies and put canvas covers. Mm-hmm. We can strike out canopies and put canvas covers.
Something.
I mean, if the intent was to address canvas.
It is.
Then let's put covers and let's call canvas or fabric based.
So that leads to a question. If you put a canvas cover there. I can't have a canvas cover over my motorcycle that's in the driveway?
No, over your garage as a roof, as part of the structure. Cover your vehicles with canvas is all you'd like. Okay. Portable garages.
The first sentence answers your question. The temporary version of any structure.
Your vehicle's not a structure.
I didn't read that. Okay.
And portable garages, we don't have a definition for that either, right?
We can define that.
And then in B, now we're getting a storage container, so I just hold my thoughts.
Before we go there, I just want to go and make sure that after the carports, section 3, on the side setback areas of the home, the carports located on the side setback may not extend beyond the setback area of the property outside the existing roof line of the garage, whichever is greater. Is that acceptable? Verbiage there.
Is that for the accessory structure code?
This is a new code for specifically addressing carports.
Where is that written?
That is under
6.3.
So the intent of this part of the code is not necessarily to limit the property owners to the length and the width, but it is often too open for the sides to be a better place. That it doesn't.
I have no problem with the concept, I just understand. Wait, this word, I have no idea what it is. So I mean, it's I don't know.
Basically, we don't want it longer than the length of the house, the side section of the house. I agree.
But we don't want it to extend past the front setback.
Not in, or the rear setback of that.
Then let's.
Do we care?
That's what I'm asking.
Definitely more of an issue on the front.
It's, I think it's more of an issue on the front, but, you know.
I don't care if it goes back, but the front, yes.
Okay, so do we want to strike this, or do we want a length restriction on it at all?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It's the only thing I'm running into where we don't have big enough properties to allow something like this, but we have people pouring slabs and parking their RVs between the houses. They back the RV up so far that it sticks out behind the house. And now, where I used to be able to look down through the houses and there are the mountains, I'm now looking at a big W or whatever on the side of somebody's RV, do I, and potentially their structure, do I want to restrict that? That's the question.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
I think you do. that doesn't make sense.
That's a compelling argument for the rear.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So that it shall not exceed.
But can I throw something out there? Is that we don't treat a cement pad as a structure. So you could still park an RV there and not, and this wouldn't change that.
Right.
It's when you wanted to put a carport on top of it.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
We restrict the carport.
Just as long as you see that.
I understand that.
Okay.
I don't think my neighbors have permission to do that. They just get along with whoever's next door. They don't. But I'm watching my neighbor and continually get populated by these aspects.
But this will be a permanent structure.
Yeah, and so holding the rear part of that structure, restricting it to the rear of the primary structure, makes sense. They still have a hole in the house. People get a car for it. That's what I'm saying.
Sure. About storage containers now? Is there a lot of the carports now? Because I looked at the drawing, sorry, I'm going back.
Okay.
Drawing 3, the carport adjacent to the front loading garage. It's close enough to the front loading garage here. It is detached, but it is within 3 feet the way it's drawn. Wouldn't that have to meet the appearance requirements? Harmonious?
Not necessarily. So, as far as...
it's not actually attached.
Well, it's not attached.
Well, okay. You, this body can make a recommendation on that. You know.
This is where it comes in conflict with this code.
Yeah.
So your point is, if it's that close, it maybe should be harmonious.
Well, otherwise you end up with put some siding, steel siding up, and, oh, but I'm not attached to the house because I got 6 inches separation. I don't, and you're just skirting around it. I think they're just,
that is a loophole if you want to kind of have more free reign, you would never attach it.
Yeah, yeah. Just attach. Keep it detached, but have it be super close.
So,
yeah, so in all effect, it will be as it's attached. But
it's attached, it's, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but it is that accessory structure. It has to comply with all the fire code and size.
It would have to have fire code, yes.
Whatever else.
Yeah.
But under that scenario, you are effectively prohibiting the prefab metal detached units.
No, what I'm thinking, because that's typically a guess. I don't know these structures.
Well, your building requirements substantially changes at that point, the closer you get to the house.
And are we getting outside of what it would take detached metal cardboard to comply with, I guess that's.
What is the minimum feet we are allowing between the primary structure and the cardboard in the setback requirements?
We don't have that specified.
Right. So, this doesn't have this recommendation, right? So,
in other words, do we say it has to be 12 feet.
But we could.
If you're closer to 12, then you're calling a different category, for sure.
Or you don't say anything at all and just recognize that if somebody tries to build within that 12-foot zone, they're basically not going to comply with building requirements with that type of structure, I guess. Again, I don't know the structure. But
people never build things that are not
going to. It's never happened.
What's so good with it?
Never.
You put that in the minutes.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, expect that from the minutes.
It didn't even go in, don't worry about it.
I think the intent of the code is you really don't want it to distract from the need for I think that's the intent that we're trying to accomplish here. The closer you get to the main building, the more you're going to distract.
I'm being told, I like the concept of 12 feet as a minimum number.
Yeah.
That will actually probably put in like having the structure all together, because luckily we don't have that much front land, 12 feet from the primary structure, plus 24 feet watch width of a carport, they probably have to put it in.
Right.
A really large side yard or whatever. And that's not the intent to get rid of that. They're saying that
they'd have to throw it in the back. They wouldn't be able to put it on the side. They'd have to throw it in the back.
That's actually going to solve a lot of issues.
Right. And they, again, pouring the concrete is fine. You just, that's the most permanent structure. You just have to move to that. All right. That's all I got. I'm finding you want to
Is there any other questions?
No, you understand what we've suggested so far here?
Yes. If you want to go 12 feet from the main building, so typically that will push things outside of the building and put them on those streets.
I would expect so.
Okay, so let's go down to storage containers. Great cargo containers, box cars, and similar equipment are prohibited as accessory structures or defined as a shed. Temporary storage containers may be used during a move but may not be present on the property for more than 72 hours. Any issues with this type of wording?
I'm just struggling with or defined as a shed because I'm assuming we have a code elsewhere talks about sheds and other accessory structure code. Or I guess what we're saying is that I guess what I'm saying is I don't want this to apply to sheds. So when we insert the word sheds in here, then you're going to be now.
I think you're saying a storage container can't be a shed. I think that's what the intent of that is.
So most of these that come into me are coming in as a shed. They want these as accessories and buildings.
What if you just changed it to say, or as prohibited, are prohibited as accessory structures, or as being defined as a shed? Because I think that's what we're trying to say is that these are not sheds.
They're not sheds.
Yes, we're not trying to define a shed. We're just saying that this is not it.
You could say storage containers, etc., will not be defined as a shed and are also prohibited as accessory structures.
I think that wording is better.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's great.
I like saying not defined as a shed because we're saying or defined as a shed here, which kind of makes my first reading of that was, oh, it's a shed.
Okay.
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 I just saw my brother move 6 months ago, and he had a cargo type container of pods put in his driveway so he could load stuff into it. It took him more than 3 days to load that and get moved.
Okay.
72 hours does seem pretty short.
Yeah.
If you're using it as a moving.
About a week.
It's listed here, temporary storage containers during the move. I think a week is probably a little more.
Okay.
I don't think anybody's going to object if they know that they're moving it there for a week instead of 3 days. I don't see that.
Where
a month it would be.
Yeah, it depends on how long the neighbors move out.
Or the new neighbors that you want to
Then you have to get over that health and immunity session.
Okay. In down at the bottom, I failed to put down in the right way. So I will be including there's fire lane, parking spaces, landscape for a couple of right ways. So that will be included in that.
Good. So when we say that they're prohibited as accessory structures, maybe we should just say they're prohibited, period, versus saying as accessory structure. What if somebody says, well, this is not an accessory structure, this is a...
Is there a main dwelling on the on the premise?
What's that?
Is there already a building on the premise? There's a main dwelling, there's a main building, and then there's an accessory structure. If there's already a building on the premise, there's no argument that it's not an accessory structure. If it's a vacant field, then there may be some. But if you prohibit them as a structure, as a permanent structure rather than...
Well, we're saying prohibited as an accessory structure.
Right, so we can just say as a permanent structure.
If it's a vacant lot, they could put a cargo container there
and call it a primary structure.
Why? Yeah, because so I mean, you could just say as a structure, prohibited as a structure, or prohibited as a permanent structure. I think she already kind of calls that out. Or she prohibited as a, you can just say permanent.
All right, I'm looking at loopholes here. I'm trying to think.
I know that's what you do. But a structure, anything is a structure.
Sure.
And so if you say that a cargo container is not allowed as a structure, I just don't see how.
What if you leave wheels on it? What if the semi truck backs it in, detaches, drives away, leaves the wheels on it?
They have 7 days to have it there.
That's a temporary structure. You have wheels.
Temporary. Okay. Good. Just want to make sure we're...
Also, you just can't have a code for every circumstance. There's going to be a curveball at some point.
Yeah.
I appreciate your creative mind.
Just trying to think outside.
Yeah, I like it.
Should we also add the prohibited accessory structures, but they're also prohibited for use as a residential structure?
I think that's a permanent structure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So maybe we should prohibit the activity of living.
Or we might be finally be able to have some moderate income housing.
Yeah.
Single run locker.
I think we want to. We could drop these in every cul-de-sac in the city.
Oh, jeez.
Tell by the public.
These are all stupid.
The general plan.
Any other, I didn't go in sequence or backwards, but maybe any other comments about cargo containers?
So as we go down under the construction aspect of it, temporary construction aspect of renovation, as far as 180 days for a project, does anybody have any issues regarding 180 days? Or do we want to limit that down to a small amount?
It's 180 days after the last inspection. That seems like a long time.
That's a long time after the last inspection. Yeah.
Sure. Have you seen the Canyon Road project? It takes a long time sometimes.
Are they doing something in the Canyon Road? I haven't noticed.
No, I mean, it depends on the project. Most are going to be well within that window.
So if they said, okay, now we'll do something that's right, you need another 180 days, you get something else to do.
Yeah, that sounds a little long.
Then you go 90? 90
days.
I like that.
I think that's...
Yeah.
Is
And then number two, can you think of any other places that these would not be allowed as far as temporary?
It shouldn't be on a recorded easement. Yeah, that's a little technical, but it could happen.
You can also add language that just says that or anywhere deemed a safety hazard.
Did carports, going back to carports, be allowed on recorded easements?
Should, well, kind of shed?
A shed.
A portable shed is, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Because a portable shed are easily moved.
That's probably a good point. Yeah. And the car always as well. Carport's not, but then easily recorded.
Yeah, and that's typically a rule of thumb anyway.
So, and two, the required parking spaces. Why required being was allocated to the
That'd be for like a commercial development. They have required parking spaces. Like, so Marco's Pizza has a number of parking spaces. Let's say that they needed to have a storage unit for a period of time. They couldn't occupy one of those storage units, one of those parking units.
Now, it's an improved surface. It's an improved surface.
Anything graded with road base, gravel.
Just not flat on dirt.
Yeah, it's just not landing on your grass.
Okay. So I think Jeff has a motion to make about pavement because he really was concerned. He really wanted to, because he hadn't had a chance to go. Oh, actually. You want to? Okay. So is this. While they're making a motion, whether someone wants to table it or whether they want to make a recommendation, I don't want to make a motion unless there's still more discussion.
As a discussion, I would say we discussed enough changes on this that it almost requires us to table it. I will move that we. Table. Review recommendation on amendments to Cedar Hill City Code related to carports, lands, the cargo containers, and accessory structures.
I'll second.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson?
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And I will say nay. I think we could accomplish this today. But I don't mind talking about it again. All right, next on the agenda is review action on approving the 2019 planning commission meeting and schedule.
I'm gonna do this real fast. Take a look at the schedule. This is a traditional day, it's 4th Thursdays. Any issues, let me know.
Can always be postponed or rescheduled too.
They can always get postponed or rescheduled.
Or canceled.
I think it's very typical that we go at least one special meeting throughout the year and things get canceled. And then obviously no meeting in December. There's no meeting next month. And then on top of that, I do want to say that all of our alternates are up. So if you want to be reappointed, please send me an email. Your terms as alternates they just expire at the end of the calendar year.
So you're saying the alternates? Mm-hmm.
The alternates just need to let me know. No. Planning commissioner, we don't have anybody that's on the commission that is a voting member that expires this year, or commission.
So hopefully the alternates will sign up again. Raise your hand. It's very exciting. So this is
if you
not long, just so you're aware.
If you re-up, you get to talk about carports with us in January.
The only comment I have to make is the 26th of November is 2 days before Thanksgiving.
I was thinking the same thing.
We can move it to...
The only reason being is it's an election year, and the canvas for the election, the city council has to meet 2 weeks after the election, so that actually falls on your normal date. So you can either not have a meeting at all, just leave it that way, and we'll just deal with it as we get there. We can always postpone it or make it... sooner, I
think we schedule it and hopefully we can decide. I mean, they might be on agenda that's potentially so
leave it on the 26th.
We can just kind of play that one by ear, be cognizant of any schedule. And if we don't have a quorum, we can't have a meeting anyway. So
So that's 2 days after report next week.
Before.
2 days before. Okay. It was after I did the right leftovers. That's not going to happen. So. All right. Anyone? I guess 7 p.m. is still ideal for everybody. What's your name? Anyone make a motion?
I move we adjourn.
We have to vote on the schedule first.
I think we should be able to make a motion.
Nice try, Jared.
He said any motion.
I know. He did say that. He did say that.
Don't like it.
Okay, I move that we approve the 2019 Planning Commission meeting schedule.
Very good. I will second the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
All right, Jared, now it's your turn.
Adjourn.
Oh, we have to make a motion to adjourn.
Oh, I move that we adjourn. Okay, I second that.
Who seconded it?
I did.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Yeah. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Now we adjourn. So you have to have that in writing?
I just tell you.